Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Research 101, the podcast hosted by the Undergraduate Research Council at Valdosta State University, where we interview professors and scholars on their research. And today we're very excited to have joining us Dr. A.J. Ramirez. Dr. Ramirez is the coordinator of VSU's Women and Gender Studies program, and her academic interests include sexism, gender discrimination, LGBTQ issues, and education reform. She teaches classes such as race, class, and gender, global feminism, queer theory, feminist theory, and LGBT studies. Dr. Ramirez earned her Bachelor of Science degree in sociology from the University of North Georgia, and both her master's degree in marriage and family therapy and her doctor of education degree from Valdosta State University. She is currently focused on addressing LGBTQ issues with the Methodist Church and the barriers imposed upon trans and gay teachers in public education. And Dr. Ramirez also practices as a professional counselor in Valdosta, Georgia. Dr. Ramirez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Fitzgerald. It's nice to be here.
Yeah. So I wanted to start us off with a question about your research. What different areas of research have you been involved in?
Well, recently, it was the two that you had just mentioned in the bio. I've been working with a colleague over at Georgia Southern, Dr. Nancy Malcolm, who's a sociologist. And we have been tackling the recent divide between the United Methodist Church over one concept only, human sexuality. And so we've been doing quite a bit of qualitative research on that with some interviews from all over the nation of individuals who are members of the church, both clergy and lay persons as well. And just trying to understand why folks actually stay involved in an institution that is so anti them, whether they be allies or members of the LGBT community. And so that's one piece of research that's really taken a great deal of time and thoughtfulness with regard to these very rich interviews of people's personal lived experiences. The other piece of research that I've been working on has just been working with the education system. It's a single case study with a pre-service teacher who graduated with their graduate degree, a master's in education, and kind of following them on this journey of discrimination, more particularly in the rural areas of the South, of trying to obtain employment as a teacher in the public school system. And it seems that through this journey that we're taking with this person, there is no reason why this individual is not being hired based on qualifications, but rather because of the preferred pronoun that this person has requested the students call them. and it's been from a personal standpoint, as a human being, it's been frustrating for me to have to hear these things. But from a scholar's perspective, it's been really fascinating of how intricate discrimination can play a role in the personal lives of professionals going forward, specifically our teachers, who you may agree with me, we are in dire need of currently.
I absolutely agree with you. And I think it's a really important thing to note when you come across in your research things that are both fascinating and frustrating. And as a scholar and a human being, that you can hold both of these emotions in response. What are some things that have really surprised you in your current areas of research?
Well, I think going when I was in grad school, I think some of the things that maybe intimidated me early on with research was how difficult it seemed or overwhelming it seemed. But what I have found great joy in and kind of maturing into that process with scholarship is finding those pieces that you're deeply connected with, and finding a sense of personal connection can motivate, I think, the researcher to go forward and really do some outstanding work. Kind of realizing how sometimes our lives parallel in different ways, but similar in some of the responses we're getting from the folks we're interviewing, I think has been really enjoyable for me. And it's really changed my perspective from, you know, and it's been a minute since I've been in grad school, but I can see over time how research is not necessarily as intimidating as it once was as a student, but more so an opportunity for me to be a part of the human experience and sharing that piece with others in my community and regional areas. So almost like a gift. And when I kind of think when I view it that way, it becomes actually enjoyable. It's a fun thing to do.
I love that. That's such a wonderful point. And that leads me to wonder about strategies for overcoming obstacles or challenges that you've faced in your research.
Well, there's always, you know, the IRB. That's probably usually the most detailed and kind of book ready kind of thing that has to be done, you know, making sure that we're ethically doing everything that's appropriate, very protocol-y. So I would say that usually is the first jump of, you know, where you kind of do that sigh. but I understand it's necessary. But once getting past that, the other obstacles are usually just getting people to respond back. Like, so if you're doing a survey and then you're opening up that opportunity for individuals to reach back out to you for a more in-depth interview, I think it's always been challenging of where to start. If you get a small sample of people, it's not difficult. But when you get an overwhelming amount of responses coming back, like 200 or 300 folks wanting to have personal interviews, and there's only 2 researchers on the project, I think that becomes overwhelming. It's a sense of excitement, but then you're also thinking, okay, how am I going to go about this? You know, where am I going to start? How am I going to, you know, make sure that I'm not showing over more attention on one area or a group of people? In my situation, you know, I wanted to make sure that those who are identifying as straight and those identifying as not straight or non-heterosexual were getting just as much of attention to be able to have that opportunity to speak to me and Nancy in this process.
That's interesting, especially because it sounds like you probably did not anticipate getting as many responses as you had, that you were surprised by that level of response. Would you agree with that?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, not at all. Like hundreds of responses back. I was quite flabbergasted, to kind of use a different word. I was excited and thrilled about it, but completely blindsided. I'm thinking, you know, who's going to care about this? You know, no one's going to care about the Methodist Church. You know, it's loaded. It's a loaded term. LGBTQ, you know, a lot of folks like, oh, it's a fit, you know, it's kind of a trend right now. But no, it was huge. And yeah, it kind of crushed some stereotypes I had as just an individual. So I'm very grateful that we went forward with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a testament to just how important this work is. You've clearly touched a nerve with current and former membership of the Methodist Church. And so, you know, I think that really emphasizes the value and the importance of the research that you're doing, that just to see this enthusiasm in responses. It's an embarrassment of riches, but what an exciting outcome.
Yeah, for sure.
So how do you typically go about your research? Do you have a specific type of method or, you know, what's your workflow like as far as methodology, place, time that you prefer to work? What does research look like for you?
Well, for me, I enjoy talking with people one-on-one. And some of that may just come from my psychotherapy background as a therapist. The opportunities, I think, to have with that communication piece of not just verbal communication, but being able to sit with the person, you know, body language, tone, you know, environment. Those things, I think, speak volumes when you're collecting important data. And so I always go more the qualitative route, just in the sense of ethnographies and interviews. Those are quite meaningful for me, kind of being immersed in the experience or the culture, or having that person take that position of expertise and share their own experience with me. Now, as far as like obviously all of our research is mixed methods. So we use, you know, Qualtrics, and we send out surveys just to kind of get an idea of what's out there. And I think I like that. So if I were to say, you know, what part of the quantitative process do you really enjoy? Well, I like surveys. You know, I think they're pretty shortcut and sweet, and they kind of get you, you know, yay or nay, you know, of the dot or the circle or the checkoff that needs to occur in that process. So that part seems pretty simple. We've got so many platforms now that you can purchase and buy other than Excel. Not to knock Excel. Excel's great if you know how to work it. But, you know, you can really sort those things into nice little pockets and compartments, and you can look at demographics and numbers and sexual orientations. And, you know, that's great. But that only tells you so much. So for me, it's getting into it. And sometimes that takes longer. You know, I understand that, you know, you choose to do a qualitative study and you're going to interview X amount of people, or you're going to do an ethnography and immerse yourself in a culture and experience. That's going to take time. But you know what? I think it's worth it. I think it's worth to kind of delay. You may not have a publication or anything out in a year or two, but when it does come out, I think it's going to be rich with detail and be very meaningful. You're getting the whole story.
Absolutely. You know, one thing that I'm hearing in your research methods, both through surveys and interviews, you know, thinking about the topics that you focus on, it seems like there needs to be an element of trust from the people you're interviewing or the people participating in your surveys, is that you need to cultivate a level of trust in order for them to participate and provide honest answers. And I'm also mindful of the fact that your professional practice is that of a counselor. And so can you talk a bit more about the element of trust in your research?
Yeah, for sure. So I would agree. And, you know, I really didn't even think about that. And, you know, it's amazing how, you know, you as your own person, when you start thinking about everything that has made you who you are, obviously comes out, you know, when you are doing the research with other people. You know, trust is an issue. And I, especially with the groups that we're working with, and one of the things we clear up immediately, you know, is if we are using Zoom or Microsoft Teams or anything like that, or Google Meets, you know, the first thing they always ask is, you know, are these going to be destroyed or deleted? And of course they are. But there is some hesitation there. And some of the stuff that we will, you know, we let them know is, please, you know, at any point in this process, if you want to stop or not answer something, you're more than welcome. You know, you can exercise that right. And I think giving that permission up front and letting folks know that you have complete control over this. And of course, I use some of my techniques and tactics from my marriage and family therapy background with regard to the interviews. But they are interviews and they are not psychotherapy sessions. I definitely want to be clear about that. You know, I'm not plowing into their personal lives about their mental health or emotional stability, but rather just asking them to share whatever is important to them based on the experiences. I would like to note that if you've ever done interviews, which I'm sure you've participated in this, Sarah, but you got to give leeway because you may ask a question and they may just take it a whole different direction. and that can be a good thing as a result of the interviews that me and Dr. Malcolm have conducted with the Methodist Church interviewees. We started out, you know, having a very specific set of questions. And by the time we had interviewed, you know, 50 or 60 people, we had a really great theme with the whether clergy were conducting gay marriages, same gender marriages when they weren't supposed to. Like, it just kept popping up. And so, of course, we're jotting this down on the side to say, okay, we need to kind of maybe come back to that in a phase two of this research, or a phase three. So we saw some different themes coming in that way. We also saw a theme of activist work. As much as these individuals were expressing the core questions of why are you staying in an institution that is demeaning and berating you for who you are as a human being, you know, we heard things like they're an activist in their own right, and they're advocating for groups of people. And so So I say all this to say that sometimes you go in with an idea, but as you continue in that process, your idea is fine. You can still go forward with that. But then you have all these other opportunities to explore further research. So, yeah.
I can certainly relate in terms of interviews and, you know, you come in with an idea of what the questions will be and the direction it goes in. And then your interviewee sometimes surprises you with new information or directions they take the conversation. And yeah, I mean, I would agree that that can be part of the process, is following that trajectory when it makes sense. But a key difference between my work as a historian and yours as a sociologist is, you know, while interpretation can change over time for history, and while, you know, new evidence, new sources present themselves, history itself does not change. But what's interesting about your research is I understand there's been an important change that happened within the Methodist Church since you began your research. Can you talk a little bit about that and the impact that it's had?
Oh, yeah, sure. So when we started our research, we just wanted to understand why people were staying in the Methodist Church with the knowledge that homosexuality was not in compliance with Christian teaching. That's what's stated in their book of discipline. And it was fascinating for us because we knew why people were leaving the church. I mean, that was clear as day, right? You're being oppressed, you're being discriminated against. For ordained individuals, they were going through seminary, doing all of this incredible work, feeling called by God to go forth and to preach. And then they get all the way down to the very end, and then the committee of ordination will ask them a question if they're actively involved in a homosexual relationship. And then, you know, that would end their career. All the hard work they did, it was done. So we understood why people were leaving. But what we didn't know was why they were staying, like why these same folks who went through seminary would still go back to the church and sit in those pews and do whatever they could to still be actively involved in the Methodist Church. So we went in with that question. And then right, literally, like in the middle of doing interviews, the Methodist Church splits, like they go through this kind of divorce. And we knew it was coming, but we didn't know when it was coming. And so then in that middle of the process, we had already interviewed, we had already completed the surveys. The surveys were all in, and then, you know, we had over 1,300 surveys completed. And then we had probably already done about maybe 17, 20, 25 interviews. And so at that point, that's where you started to hear narrative shift where, well, my church is disaffiliating. So now I am leaving, but I'm not leaving the Methodist Church. I'm leaving the global Methodist Church. And so now we had, you know, all sorts of comments and frustrations, and we were literally getting people's raw experiences through this. It was terrible. I think it was a terrible process for many of these people. And so, big changes happen. And while historically we know that the Methodist Church has multiple splits throughout the centuries, whether it be abolition work with slavery or the ordination of women or the civil rights movement back in the 50s and 60s. Here we were again, and me and Dr. Malcolm just happened to be right in the middle of it during this split. So it was notable. It was pretty exciting.
That's a really fascinating experience. And it's, I think, incredibly valuable that you were able to capture people's responses in real time and how that actually would affect their decisions. Can you share a bit about what your favorite and least favorite parts of research are?
I think I'll start with the least favorite. The least favorite part for me is just the amount of time that it takes with documentation and proofreading and having, you know, 2, 3, 4 sets of eyes kind of look through everything you've done. I mean, time, I think in a way, time is always kind of my nemesis with anything, whether it's, you know, whatever you're doing at work, or if you're at a really great event and you're like, oh, all good things must come to an end. So for me, the time part can be difficult as far as managing deadlines and trying to get information out in a meaningful time frame. And like I said before, when you're doing work like qualitative work, it's going to take time. But something like this, because we have kind of gone right in the middle of the split of the church and we were getting that information in real time as people's lives were changing, we now, and I know Dr. Malcolm's not here, but I know we've had discussion about how it almost feels like our responsibility to a certain degree to kind of present some of this information, you know, in an adequate amount of time before this time passes us. So that then creates additional deadlines of how many more interviews do we want to do, or, you know, how much longer do we want to spend time on this piece or, you know, or this theme. So time would be my least favorite piece of it because it creates a sense of anxiety. My favorite piece of research is kind of what I said earlier in the podcast, is that when you find something that you can connect to personally, I think that's the part that makes me excited about wanting to do the research, wanting to meet with the people, wanting to talk with them, wanting to do, you know, collect information through literature reviews and things of that nature. I think that really is the key, is finding that connection of what speaks to you. I just think you do better research when you're personally motivated and invested in the topic. As a professor, I think, you know, we think about this in the classroom. You know, we give our students assignments and things to do, and if we just, you know, give them busy work, I can't speak for you, Sarah, but I know for me, I get some pretty awful work back, some papers and, you know, activities that just don't seem, they didn't seem that invested. But if I take an assignment and I give them an opportunity to choose what they want to write on, or, you know, present on a specific topic and keep it within a certain theme, but they have a little more liberty into what they can choose within that social problem or something along those lines, then I feel like when I'm reading those papers or activities, they're just so much better because you can tell that they had this personal connection with it. So I think that carries over in research. And I think, you know, as professors, we're teaching our students early on that there is this kind of correlation between what you're interested in and what you can write about or research about.
I very much share your experience in seeing the difference in students when you assign projects where they're able to bring in their passion. And as professors doing research, a lot of times we focus on a topic for a long time, right? We research something for an extended period of time so that passion, that personal connection can really help maintain interest and motivation over that long term. You know, building on this idea of giving students assignments that build on their passion, can you talk a bit more about just general advice you have for students when it comes to research? What advice do you want to give students about research?
Oh, that's such a good question. Because had you asked me in undergraduate school, what do you want to do research, AJ? I'd be like, oh, no way. I guess it would depend, you know, if it's an undergrad student, I would probably, you know, share my own experience, obviously, of how it took me time to be connected to what I was interested in. But I guess I would tell them that, you know, when you take your statistics course or your research methods course, you know, those are intimidating classes just because you're learning what I call the framework, the basics. You're kind of learning all of the important stuff that needs to be done to get the job done effectively. But the bare bones is not the research itself. The bare bones just sets up that framework so that you can build a beautiful home around it in the architectural design that you desire. So it just kind of maybe reframing to them that research is not your statistics class or your research methods class. I know they say it is, but it's not. It's just the framework. And trying to get them encouraged, like, you know, don't base the rest of your life on those classes? Because I can tell you, I mean, those were not my best classes in undergraduate school. I mean, I did great in grad, but in undergrad, no way. So had I taken the perspective that, oh my gosh, this defines me going forward as a researcher or scholar, then I would have never gone forward and did any more work. You know, I would have just forgot about it and thought research sucks. But I think if we look at research as opposed to just a college assignment or an academic endeavor that requires some sort of numerical grade that will justify your GPA, and we look at it more as an opportunity as you to connect with others and to learn something valuable that the rest of the world may not know, that's research. That's taking something new or something that doesn't have a lot of information on that you enjoy and learning about it and sharing it, you know, just kind of simplifying it like that.
That's really encouraging. That's a very motivating way to look at research, because I do think for some students, the concept of research can be intimidating if they limit themselves to, you know, just their class assignments, but to go at it with this idea of passion and curiosity and, you know, the goal of sharing new information, you know, that's something that we can do at all levels. That's not just for professors and folks writing books. I mean,
that's right.
Students, I have seen countless examples of students doing really compelling research. And I think that's a very encouraging and great way to look at it. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, those are all the questions I have, Dr. Ramirez. Thank you again for taking part in our podcast today and sharing about your research and the things that you are learning.
You're welcome, Dr. Fitzgerald. Thank you for having me.